Today I'm joined once again by Nico, the geopolitical analyst from geopoliticalmonitor.com. Nico, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me back, James.
All right, Nico, what's going on in the geopolitical scene this month?
Well, there are a number of interesting and important events that have taken place. We have Kosovar independence. We have the incident in South America between Colombia and Venezuela and Ecuador. We have the Hezbollah assassination in the Middle East, continuing U.S. economic decline, and then the Iranian sanctions. So I'll just discuss each of those. First off, earlier in the month, we had the separation of Kosovo. And to understand the situation there, you have to look at it in a historical context. Essentially, this is just one of the last phases of the Balkanization, the fractionalization of the former Yugoslavia. So Kosovo, up until just recently, was a province of Serbia. And Serbia and the entire region, the Balkans, used to be Yugoslavia, which was formed after World War I. It was called the Land of the Southern Slavs, which is the translation for Yugoslavia. And it was a monarchy at the time that consisted of Serbs, Slovenes, and Croats. But then during World War II, it was occupied by the Axis and then fell into communist hands. And with the 1980s uncertainty with communist countries, the collapse of the Soviet Union, we saw that there was more and more ethnic division, ethnic conflict in that region that was always to some extent unstable because of the ethnic rivalries and clashes. So then between 1991 up until to the present, or at least until 2001, we saw a war, significant conflict in the Balkans. In 1991, first Macedonia separated, and they were largely able to avoid any conflict. And then Slovenia separated in a 10-day war with Yugoslavia, where Yugoslavia attempted to prevent separation by using their army to man the borders and prevent, basically alienate the country, sever them from the rest of the country and the rest of the region. This ultimately was unsuccessful. They allowed separation. And then the Croatian War of Independence soon followed, where Croatia declared independence and the region's minority Serbs refused to go along with it. And that was a particularly brutal and nasty war. And that continued until 1995, when the Croats reclaimed their entire territory with a brutal and efficient strike. And about 250,000 Serbs fled the region. And Croatia was formed as its ethnic identity. And what happened then after 1995 is that the conflict spread. NATO entered and bombed the Slobodan Milosevic's army, the Yugoslav army, and approximately 100,000 people died with 2.5 million internally displaced. So this was a significant conflict. And then we had further Balkanization. Croatia and Bosnia and Herzegovina were separated. And then we had clashes between Kosovo and the Serb military. And in 1999, NATO went in and started providing a presence. And that's continued on until present day, now in February of 2008, when Kosovo has finally declared independence. So this is essentially something that's been a long time coming and is potentially the last country to separate of the former Yugoslavia. Russia and Serbia, of course, are very unhappy with this development, but there's little, if anything, they can do. Essentially, as Alexander Lukashenko has said, the president of Belarus, the time to prevent Kosovar succession has long passed. And with the European Union influence in the region, Russia can only stick to rhetoric and calling the separation illegal and setting a dangerous precedent. So Russia has said that this precedent could apply with South Osseta, the separatist region in Georgia, which is pro-Russia, but they're unlikely to push this too strongly because of Russia's separatists in Chechnya. So it's an interesting situation, but despite minor conflicts that have been taking place, this looks like something that is here to stay despite any uncertainty or hostility towards the development.
It certainly is an interesting situation. Can you give us some insight as to why the EU and the US are supporting the Kosovar independence?
Well, from a European Union perspective, It's trying to, one, take that entire region out of Russian control, and that's even more true with the Ukraine, to a lesser extent, Belarus, but certainly with Georgia. They're trying to expand their powers throughout the European Union and to Eastern Europe, which is all former Russian territory, to ensure that they have a buffer to expand NATO and to further alienate or pressure Russia. And the United States is in on it as well. There's speculations as to the various interests involved, but fundamentally, I think the issue is that NATO got involved due to the extent of the conflict during the 1990s war, and this is just the continuation of NATO involvement in trying to stem the flow of violence, gain control of the region, and create stability and economic prosperity.
Okay, what can you tell us about the South American situation with Venezuela, Colombia, and Ecuador?
So to give some background into the diplomatic incident in South America that's been taking place over the past number of weeks, you have, generally speaking, South America, which, according to U.S. plans, was supposed to be their backyard, where they'd get their oil, where they control for resources, and that was the extent for many decades, with the CIA and United States overthrowing democratically elected leaders and keeping puppet regimes in power. In recent years, however, this has changed, most notably with the rise of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and he is a very vocal opponent of United States rule and has really rallied together many South American countries in opposition of U.S. interests. Colombia, on the other hand, is very tied to the United States. CIA drug running from Colombia brings huge amounts of money into the CIA and both the American economy as well. And the 1980s crack cocaine epidemic was largely the result of CIA cocaine smuggling in order to fund covert operations and be independent. So a lot of money is at stake with the cocaine. It's a country that the U.S. has military bases in that they can implement throughout South America. So that's their foothold of strength in the region. And also the current government is, to a certain extent, pro-U.S. And the rebel group opposed to that pro-U.S. stance that the government has taken is the FARC rebel group. And unsurprisingly, Chavez, the anti-U.S. leader in Venezuela, has taken some sympathy on FARC, not by outright supporting them in any visible sense, but certainly through diplomatic channels, trying to negotiate the release of prisoners and that sort of thing. And also there's speculation that both Ecuador and Venezuela haven't been as strict as they could be in preventing FARC from crossing their borders to help have camps away from the Colombian military and to regroup. And what happened just recently that caused the diplomatic row was that Colombia invaded Ecuador in order to assassinate a FARC leader that was at a base across the border in Ecuador. Now, in the past, without this strong, united South America, this is an event that would likely have gone with little or no reprisal. But with Hugo Chavez and the new alliance that he's attempting to create in South America in opposition to U.S. interests, what happened was something very different. Both Ecuador and Venezuela cut off all diplomatic ties, and they sent their military to line the borders with Colombia. Now, it's a little bit more dramatic if you're looking at a map, but this, to a large extent, encircles Colombia. And not only did Ecuador and Venezuela sanction Colombia for their actions, but also Nicaragua got involved as well. And then much more tacitly and neutrally, both Brazil and Chile condemned the violation of Ecuador's sovereignty. So essentially, much of South America was rallying against Colombia and essentially rallying against U.S. interests. And this is what created the diplomatic stir. Now, because of the nature of South America, because of the geological and geographical divides between the countries, it has largely been a stable region. It just doesn't make sense geographically to invade because of mountains, large marshes, and also, for the most part, the countries are more or less aligned. So this incident, despite being one between Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela, in reality, I think, is a conflict between the United States and these anti-United States countries. Obviously, fighting the FARC is pushing a U.S. agenda, and also fighting Venezuela, which is a major oil exporter to the United States and elsewhere, is also in the United States' interest because they want someone other than Chavez in power. So this whole incident, to a certain extent, relates to the ongoing feud between Venezuela and the United States. And I think what sums this up the most and best is that the United States has recently said that they're going to put, or threatening to put, Venezuela on a terrorist blacklist to implement sanctions against Venezuela for allegedly providing $300 million to FARC in order to fund their so-called terrorist campaigns. Now, what's interesting about this, and what was pointed out by investigative journalist Greg Pallast, is that the laptop seized by the Colombian military that supposedly provide proof of this occurrence, in fact, say nothing about $300 million or any sort of transfer. So this is a trumped-up allegation in order to allow the United States to make grandiose claims and make threats against Venezuela. It seems unlikely but not impossible that they would actually go ahead with such sanctions because of the large amount of oil that Venezuela does provide the United States. A lot of money is on the line here. So I think to a large extent, this is just political rhetoric. And Chavez, in character, derided and made fun of such American threats and did not seem to take them seriously at all. So this is an interesting development, but I think despite what it may look like on the surface, it doesn't reflect an underlying threat of war or hostility between South American nations.
It is an interesting story, and another bizarre angle to it is that in 1999, Reuters reported that Richard Grasso, the former head of the New York Stock Exchange, actually went to meet with FARC rebels and trying to encourage them to invest in the New York Stock Exchange. It was a rather bizarre moment and makes you wonder what the U.S. connections to FARC might be.
I have heard about that story.
Yes.
And what I heard is that when FARC said, no, we're investing our money here in Colombia, then that is certainly what ramped up or perhaps even instigated the aerial pesticide sprayings of the region and the war against FARC. As an interesting aside, because of the liquidity that the drug trade provides to the U.S. economy, as most of the money goes through the New York Stock Exchange, if all legal drug production were to cease, so the stats go, then the U.S. economy would collapse because such a huge amount of money through drugs goes through the U.S. economy and stock exchange.
All right, very interesting stuff. Moving on to the Middle East, I understand you have some information about the recent Hezbollah assassination.
So on February 13th, Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General, Imad Muganiya, now my apologies for the pronunciation, was assassinated in Damascus, Syria. And Hezbollah is an organization that's aligned with Iranian Shia, and it was the result of a militia that was formed after the Lebanese Civil War, where those Shia wanted an entity to represent them both politically and militarily. And then when Israel invaded in order to attack Palestine separatists or Palestine militants who were operating out of southern Lebanon, Hezbollah has since, in addition to working towards improving social conditions with their hospitals and schools and their political body, have also been waging a war against the occupying Israeli military. So they and Hamas constitute the two major opposition groups to Israel dominance in the region. So after the assassination, which Israel denied they were a part of, but which every other Muslim Middle East country seemed to consider that they were involved with, and the kind of underlying expectation or thought is that it was an Israeli intelligence hit. Despite all of that, Israel has threatened to continue with both targeted assassinations, as reported in Kuwaiti and Iranian media, and has also threatened Hezbollah that if they retaliate against the assassination, then they will invade, just as they did in 2006 in the Lebanese War, when they invaded southern Lebanon to take out all of the Hezbollah military centers and their military might. So this, in conjunction with what we're seeing in the Gaza Strip, with the isolation, the cutting of electricity, and the threat of targeted assassinations, seems to be a continuance of Israel's plan to try to take out important leadership figures and also to cut off their enemies in order to lessen their diplomatic and military effectiveness.
You mentioned the 2006 Lebanese conflict with Israel. Of course, most commentators and analysts believe that Israel was not defeated during that war, but did not really accomplish their military objectives. Do you think that they're maybe trying to flex their muscle a little bit to show that they've improved their techniques or are more capable of dealing with Hezbollah right now?
Well, it's uncertain the extent to which they were effective in undermining Hezbollah's military capacity. The concern held by Israel during the war, or prior to the war, was that Hezbollah was stockpiling significant amounts of weapons, and their military capacity was increasing significantly. So Israel got a lot of flak for their use of cluster bombs, their attacking of civilians, and the widespread environmental damage, infrastructure damage, and loss of life. But the extent to which they're able to decrease Hezbollah's military capacity is hard to know for sure. Based on reports, it seems as if it was effective to some extent, but if you don't cut off the supply chains, then it's not hard to simply start replenishing that weapon supply. So it's an ongoing issue. I don't think anything is going to change very fundamentally in the short term. A lot of it is diplomatic grandstanding, but I think the fundamental message is that Israel is likely to continue in their attempt to isolate both Hamas and Hezbollah, attempt to assassinate key leaders, although there was a report from an Israeli government official that they will not try to assassinate certain high-profile political members of Hamas. But essentially, this strategy of assassination, alienation, and threats of broader military conflict seems to be continuing.
All right, well, let's move on to talk about the U.S. economy. What can you tell us about recent turmoil in the U.S. economy?
The American economy continues to decline. The fundamentals of significant exported production capacity and the rapid appreciation due to the expansion of the money supply of the U.S. dollar continues. Gold reached $1,000, which is an all-time high. The USD continues to sink, setting new records continuously. And now, an interesting fact, the European Union is the world's largest economy after the USD has continued to decline. So that's a landmark event. But what we're seeing is continued decline, and more economists are saying that the US is now currently in a depression, which is something that some people have been saying for some time. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve in the United States, the organization that takes care of monetary policy, has been putting all sorts of liquidity into the market, into the economy, printing money left and right, furthering inflation in an attempt to prop up what is an inherently unstable system. And most notably, just recently, Bear Stearns, which is a major U.S. investment bank, they were essentially insolvent. They went bankrupt. But rather than letting such a major institution fail, which would have had potentially catastrophic consequences, the Fed has said they're going to bail them out and essentially bail out other subprime mortgage investors to a tune of $2 billion. So this is very significant because it flies in the face of the laissez-faire approach that these very banks have been advocating for a significant amount of time in order to erode the New Deal policies that were implemented after the Great Depression. So what we see is a continuance of American economic decline. The fundamentals are still not there, so there's no reason to think that the U.S. economy and U.S. dollar will do anything but continue to decline. In a more practical sense, what we see also is continued inflation of food. Now, this is something that's happening worldwide, but also in the U.S. market as well, where families more and more are having difficulty buying basic food items. And an interesting aside to all of this is that Iran finally did go ahead and open up their oil exchange and commodities exchange. Now, at the moment, it's very small and hasn't been adopted. But this is perhaps a harbinger of things to come as the U.S. economy continues to decline. If this Iranian oil bourse, which exchanges oil and other petroleum products in currencies other than the USD, were ever to take hold, it could be the death blow to the USD and American economy. Now, I should note, just as an aside, the speculation regarding the oligarch plans surrounding the collapse of the U.S. economy, the idea being that the USD will be allowed to collapse, and then this will be justification for further integration, both in North America with Canada and Mexico, but also with the United States and the EU. So this is a potential consequence of this, and it'll be interesting to see how things pan out as this continues.
It certainly will. And in the short term, I guess the relative rise of the European Union as a financial power might also combine with the recent Lisbon Treaty to perhaps make something more of a political entity of the European Union. Where do you see the European Union going from this point?
Well, certainly the direction that the European Union has been headed, and the direction it seems to continue to be headed, is further integration. So not only by adding new members, but also by pushing through a common constitution that is being pushed through without the referendums that many countries thought would be required when they got involved, by furthering the use of the euro, and by generally consolidating power. Now, this has some positive benefits as well. By implementing the economies throughout the EU, it certainly creates more power for the Union, creates certain economic advantages, but if abused or if taken over by certain nefarious elites, then there are certain threats that exist. And we see this certainly in Britain with the talk of the implementation of the DNA database, of all sorts of spying. We see it with what appears to be MI6 or intelligence involvement with the 7/7 bombings, certainly with bombings in Spain. So there are all sorts of different groups involved, and to what extent these nefarious groups will be able to implement a strategy of centralized control is left to be seen.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about recent sanctions against Iran. What can you tell us about the politics behind that?
Well, despite China and Russia's support for Iran in order to prevent American dominance and influence in the country through an invasion or through weakening the country through sanctions, as was done with Iraq, just recently, a UN security resolution was passed sanctioning Iraq for their involvement in nuclear weapons or nuclear power. And it's interesting because, obviously, to pass a UN Security Council resolution, both Russia and China have to sign off on it. So Russia highlighted the fact that nowhere in the resolution is the use of military force permitted. And China, I'm not aware of them saying anything on the issue. But it's interesting that Russia and China would seemingly reverse their role and support this American-backed resolution, and it's uncertain as to what benefit from the United States or from Western countries they got in order to do so. One consideration is that neither country really wants Iran to have a nuclear capacity, despite Russia's nuclear support, because that's a threat to them. But it's unclear what benefit Russia and China got from signing on, and what this means for future resolutions or sanctions. One important note militarily is that it looks more and more certain that Iran will get the missile air defense system from Russia that would put a significant dent into any U.S. plans of an aerial bombardment sometime down the road. So what we see with this sanction is, on the one hand, Russia and China are supporting Iran, and on the other hand, they're not.
So do the sanctions apply to military equipment, like the anti-aircraft weapons or things like that?
The sanctions are very targeted, and this could have been part of the point in getting Russia and China on side. They target specific individuals, specific industries, in order to attempt to weaken and disable Iran's ability to further its nuclear program. But also, outside of this official sanction, we see unofficial European Union and U.S. sanctions. One example is the United States putting significant pressure on the European Union not to do business with Iranian banks that are established in Europe. And interestingly enough, Iran, perhaps in response or perhaps of a broader policy, has started setting up its own investment banks to gain a certain amount of independence from the Western-based financial institutions.
Very interesting. A wealth of information today, Nico. Let's talk a little bit about your website. For those who are listening for the first time, could you tell us a little bit about geopoliticalmonitor.com?
Geopoliticalmonitor.com is a forecasting and analysis website to provide insightful points on geopolitical trends and to give a sense of what's likely to come in the future. And the domain name for that site is www.geopoliticalmonitor.com. And in the weekly forecast section, you'll be able to read more about some of the items that we've discussed today. Also, listeners of the Corbett Report can get a discount on the subscription fee by entering the coupon code JCorbett when registering. And that goes to help support the Corbett Report podcast and help James continue to do all the great work that he's doing.
All right, Nico, thank you again for joining us today, and I'm very much looking forward to next month's update.
Thank you, James.